Off the ball. Rugby.
He was at the Stormers for a long time.
Yeah.
He's such a good coach. And I say coach, I mean the work ethic, the detail, the way he conveys it. No ego. You don't see him trying to take any media limelight. He's not come with celebrity. He just wants to win. And I think he's like one of the best coaches I've ever come across.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Hurling Pod.
On Off the Ball.
With Apple Green. Making every journey better.
Hurling Pod time. I promise this week we won't go beyond 2 hours. A few people were comparing us to the Odyssey. I think we were called the Podyssey in some comments last week as well because we went well over 2. That is the nature sometimes when we allow the audience to come along and join us on YouTube and the listeners are throwing in questions and we just kind of keep going. And then we realise, crap, the clock has actually gone over 2 hours in that top left-hand corner while we're recording. So this week I promise we're going to be far more disciplined as we look forward to the quarterfinals. We're down to 6 teams left in the Championship. And we've got a couple of more managerial vacancies after the week that has been. Both Waterford and Wexford now looking for new management. Peter Queeley wanted another year in Waterford, but he felt he didn't have the full backing of the Waterford County Board. And Keith Rossiter went by his own decision not to seek a fourth year in charge of the Wexford Hurlers. Both teams, of course, made early exits from the Championship, not getting out of the round robins in Munster and Leinster, respectively. So we'll talk about all that. We might take some of your questions and comments from last week as well. But James Skell, how are you keeping with your super sexy headphones this week?
Super sexy. I wasn't expecting that, Will, to be honest. But keeping very well. Thanks, Les. I finally got some fine weather.
I know, but they look so well. So one of Skell's brood, young Esme, was on with us just a few minutes ago before we started. Wanted to say hello and then got really shy before we started. And my first instinct when Skell took off his headphones and went, you know what, those headphones are far classier than the white, non-distinct headphones that you get with your phone when you buy them.
But I know that they're classier in terms of looking, but they're way more comfortable. I don't know about you guys, but when I have the white earphones in too long, my ears are getting sore.
Yeah, but what I noticed with that, and you might notice it in the old ones, was just the fact, you pull them out and you're like, jeez, my ear's getting sore here now, and you have to start fiddling around with your ear and then popping back in. You only notice it,
You used to get the big lump ear wax out too.
Father Jack. It's our first Father Ted reference, but it's like Father Jack with the ear wax, just pulling them out, Oh, no.
The first Father Ted reference of this season, actually. We kind of went...
We went heavy in some seasons.
We're very heavy early doors with Father Ted, but now I think The Simpsons probably gets referenced a bit more than the Father Ted, but I'm more than happy to bring it back. Scale's more than happy to shake his head.
Are you guys well up on Simpsons,
Up till about season 11 or season 12. After that,
I don't know.
I don't know what Simpsons that was now, but I would say up till around 2005, 2006, something like that. I don't know anything about the new ones. I wouldn't have seen it, but all the old ones.
So you're watching Simpsons up to your 17 or 18?
Oh, longer than that. Rewatches all over the place.
Yeah, just rewatches. Like I think it would have just been in the routine is like years ago, before the options you have now for you're watching loads of stuff on your phone. 2006, you didn't have that. So when you're eating your dinner, you throw on RTE or whatever, and it's The Simpsons is on at like 6:30 or whatever. That's not the case now. So like, you actually had the option where if I'm eating my dinner or something, I'd be flicking on YouTube. What I'd be watching back then when I was like 17, 18 was whatever's provided for me, which is...
Sorry, go on. I just got an image of you at 18 years of age sitting down at your dinner, really excited to watch The Simpsons. At 18 years of age, like, what's wrong with the world? And I recover your tracks.
Do you know what I actually started watching over the last while, which I loved, was I started watching it during my paternity leave, actually, was Outdoor Boys. Did I mention this? It's on YouTube. Lots of people listening now will know what this is. It's a guy living in Alaska who goes out and does these like extreme staying out overnight in like 3 feet of snow, and he builds these shacks. Skell, I think you'd actually love this, but he builds these shacks and he'd be like telling you all about like he'd be staying in places with grizzly bears. And like, so one of the things he did was he always wanted a walrus head. So he heard a walrus had like washed up in a street or on a beach in Alaska somewhere. So he flies out and he gets dropped by what are them planes that can land on water? Like a water plane?
Oh, yeah. Are they called aquaplanes? I think that's someone I'm sure I'll point them out, anyway.
But he lands on one of them and he spends like 3 days and he has to walk like 4 miles across like grizzly bear country to get to this walrus, gets the head, because he wants to bring it back and get it taxidermied. But then as he's walking back, he's like, I'm now walking with bear bait on a sled, and gets back and he wraps it up in black plastic and is camping beside the water. And he was like, invariably a grizzly bear is going to come here tonight. So we just need to know like what to do, blah, blah, blah. And like, I'm just there going, how are you in grizzly bear country? Just going to bed, sleeping for the night, gets 8 hours, and he'll just be doing all these things. It's unbelievable. So I watched that during paternity leave. I watched loads of outdoor, but it's called Outdoor Boys, but it's only one fella. So
okay. So it's just an amphibious aircraft is what you call it. One that can land on the water. But I know exactly the one you mean. I kind of expect more to see it out of a James Bond movie. You can call it a seaplane as well, apparently.
Yeah, this fella's being himself, is he?
Yeah. So do you know what he did? He was like a solicitor and he was living in like West Virginia somewhere. During COVID then, he was always into camping and like the outdoors.
It's always COVID when someone decides to have a sharp change.
And he moved back to Alaska, and then he just said, I'll just bring out a GoPro with me and start recording a few videos during it. And he goes out. One of the ones, he gets onto this train and he can give the train, it's going across Alaska, he can give the train like a grid reference and tell him, listen, I want you to drop me off here. And the train just stops and leaves you off in the middle of nowhere. And he could be like 4 hours drive from the nearest village, and he'll be in this like on the side of a mountain, and he'll put himself in a condition where he has to, like, if he doesn't like set up a shack and a fire and all this, he'll like have hypothermia and all this, and he just does all these extreme things. But it's like the ultimate outdoors, man. It's so entertaining. It's so entertaining. And he's like this kind of, he's like this kind of half nerdy guy as well. He's not like this like bear of a man either. Like,
he's half nerdy guy, so you don't expect it, I think. I wouldn't out the window more now, and I see a bit of a wood. There's a wood down the road there. I wonder if I make a career out with the GoPro and get a badger or something.
I was only thinking it. I said, you couldn't really do it in Ireland. Like, there's only so many wildernesses in Ireland where, like, this fella is in Alaska. There's like just a ridiculous amount, and then you have to add in the wolves and the grizzly bears and all this stuff. Whereas like in Ireland, you're like, I'm camping out in Connemara here. There's only so much threat. Like, I'm sure that's dangerous in its own way if you're not prepared. But like I was saying, maybe his surroundings are a little bit more conducive.
Well, as part of your training, then, for your profession, did you have to get left off in the middle of nowhere and find your way?
Well, you do. As part of your training, you have to do what's called SEER training. It's basically survival training, where in recruit training and cadet training, what they do is you do 24 hours where you won't eat food, and you basically all have to kind of like set up a fire, set up a shack. It's essentially as if you were in a helicopter and it's after crashing, and now how do you survive? So they get you cold, they get you wet, and then you have to start a fire. We had a fellow there recently, actually, a lad called Stephen McCall, and he went to French Guiana. This is only about 4 weeks ago. Went to French Guiana, to the Amazon, did 8 days. So 17 days in the Amazon altogether, but 8 days out. And during it, like, they had to do, so they had to keep, they had to walk about like 6 kilometers a day, which takes an hour to walk a kilometer. And there was jaguars and pumas and all this. At night, they had to wear white socks because vampire bats would bite you at night. And the only way you could see if you were bitten was that. Then they had to cross the Amazon at one stage. And when they were crossing, he said they had to bang the water because to make sure the caimans, the crocodiles and anacondas would kind of scare them. So like, he was like, once you bang the water, they get scared and they go off. And I was like, all right, I would like to be wading into the Amazon going, oh, the anacondas are definitely gone here now, you know. And then once they got across to the far side, they were captured. So basically simulated capture, and they were basically interrogated. So you were trained in interrogation to basically prolong your life. And then he escapes from that and has to go like 5 or 6 kilometers to an extraction point where a helicopter will pick you up. So it was 8 days. He slept about 20 hours in the 8 days, and they had no food. They just had to, whatever. This lad is, I think he's from Cork or somewhere, actually. I didn't really ask him. But I was like, you applied to do that. Like, you applied to actually, you know, do that course. And he was voted best soldier on it, best person. It was amazing. Amazing, like.
And, like, would they waterboard you and stuff as if what a kind of another combat would do to you? Like, or is it a bit lighter than that?
No. Have you ever seen, do you ever see that Ray Goggins program where, what is it, Ultimate Hell Week? Do you know that one? Yeah. So do you ever see in that where they like put people in stress positions and stuff where like, I'm going to say it's safe. It's very tough, but they're not going to jeopardize someone's actual health. And like waterboarding, very dangerous, obviously. So they've been like stress positions, maybe with hoods over their head. And I don't know anything really about that aspect that he did, but I'm just saying, like, if you see any of those things around the world, it's usually like, you know, people would be in rooms with like loads of noises, bright light, hoods on their heads, and in like stress positions. So it's just made to mess you up and mess up your body clock and all those things. So I don't actually know much about that part of it, but wouldn't be great after 7 days.
No,
you
know, I don't know much about it. You know, what about it?
But like after spending 7 or 8 days trying to avoid jaguars and pumas and anacondas, and then suddenly a lad starts playing heavy metal music and put a bag over your head.
But to achieve what though? I don't understand this.
So it was a course to get to another level of survival training. So like,
well, yes, survival training.
Sorry.
Look, anacondas. One thing people chasing you, fucking animals, right?
Anacondas.
Anacondas. I mean, jeez. Anaconda.
What I was saying to your man was that anacondas don't know it's a course you're on. Like they don't know that you're like this isn't life or death.
I mean, Jesus, that's what's wrong.
Snakes or anything like that now. I'd be just
don't worry, it's fine, Skelly. He managed to shake the water before I got in. The anaconda's one.
My heart rate now is at 79 beats per minute. I'm just thinking about anaconda slithering down the water and I'm trying to get out. And I'm tasty looking. That's a lot of me.
An anaconda, you tie an anaconda over for a year, I'd say.
Fucking hibernate the bastard.
I can already see a timestamp at some point in the YouTube. Someone's like, hurling chat begins 9:24 or something like that for this week. But sure, look, it's where we go. We will take some of the questions from the listeners now in a second as well. But I am quite glad that we're not the football pod for this week, because I saw some of the flack those boys are taking after their previews for the weekend. And this is why I always say to you guys, this is why I hate doing predictions, because you do predictions, nobody cares what you talk about for the other hour of the podcast. All they're going to do is go back for either that clip or that segment that they found where you've written their team off. And I believe that even some members of the Cork management were talking about the 15 points that Paddy Andrews had predicted that they were going to get beaten by up in Donegal. And we had a quick listen back earlier on, Murph, and the football pod got pretty much all their predictions wrong last week.
They got a good few wrong, and I was
wildly wrong.
Yeah, wildly wrong. And I had sympathy. Now, at the same time, when you put your neck out there and you say, like, as we've done several times, like, you nail your colours to the mast with the predictions. Like, the predictions are, of all the things you do, let's say, with any sort of, like, the podcasting or anything, the predictions are just, I'm not going to say they're the worst part of it, but if we had a championship and or a league or whatever where only the favourites ever won, the whole thing would be brutal. You know, you need the results to turn it over. That's what creates the excitement. I understand the one, though, as well, with the 15 points. Like, Donegal are going to be caught up with 15. That was, yeah, like, I mean, in fairness, I'd say Paddy Andrews himself was expecting lads to say it to him as well. But sure, but the predictions, it's just, what am I even trying to say with it? It's just such a... It's just not a pleasant part of it to go, oh God, you know, what are we going to call it? And we're going to do the predictions for next weekend. And like, happily, if we get them wrong, we get them wrong. But the one thing about the football, though, to give the boys credit for, like, there's some spread of teams that can turn each other over there, like, which is...
It's been unbelievable. But it has been one of the best championships of all time.
It's been very good. It's been very good. And, like, if you actually look, the excitement over the weekend, to be fair, Roscommon, Connacht champions, I know we're stealing the thunder here now of the hurl or the football pod, but, like, Roscommon being beat by Monaghan, and then you have Cork, who were brutal in the Munster championship, or Munster final, going up beating Donegal up in Ballybuffet and stuff. Like, so it is. It's brilliant. It's what you want.
But do you think the rule, if you contrast now where the football sport as a sport was, let's say 3 years ago, maybe further back, I'm not too sure. The introduction of these new rules, has that created a level of parity amongst teams?
Yeah, I think it has. Yeah.
So the two pointer seems to be like, you know how, I don't know, I always wonder about in rugby and NFL how they get the scores of each, or the points awarding of each score, like, do you know what I mean? Rugby, 5 point try, 2 point, and then it gets really close to the end where it's within reach of a drop goal. The 2 pointer has done that now in football, whereby you're always in with the shout. But even watching the Galway game today, the football, there were 8 up or 9 up, and next thing they got back to like 2 or 3. You go, geez, this is hairy stuff now.
Yeah,
it makes me think then, like, should you know how sometimes in hurling, well, a lot of the time actually, we see distances they open up very fast in hurling.
Yeah,
if we did something like that. You know, where we just a slight rule change, because you asked the question, Will, it was 2 weeks ago about rule changes, and I couldn't think on the spot but I just think that rule change for the football has made it really, really interesting and created, I won't say kind of a different playing field where tactics come into it more. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
that's how it's so good at the moment, surely, is it?
Is this you trying to bring in a hurling 2-pointer?
Not
necessarily, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I would love to see a rule. I've had time to think about it now, sorry. And I'd like to see a rule where we can control the positions of players better. So instead of having teams that can bring 10 lads behind the ball in their own 65, how do we control that better in hurling. That's what I'd like to see now. I'm nailing my colours to match that rule. And I think if you keep people within their, you know, their area, you'd have a much better game. Do you know what I mean? Because even I just think the tactics sometimes outweigh the quality of player.
So would you bring in a free then, a bit like the football three up rule, that if you don't leave enough players in the opposition half, you get a free against you?
So this confused me today. Sorry now, when someone said there was a breach, you know, on the games, allow them in, I was like, what the hell is a breach?
Yeah.
You know, so then I'm harassing on to Google to find out. I was like, that's a decent rule. I see what that happens. Possession turns over. I'm thinking, would this be good in hurling? Like, where you have to keep players in certain zones, you know? Mm. And it makes me think of Limerick. And I'm not trying to screw Limerick here. It's like, I feel like it's Limerick, like when the Dublin were going really well, they sort of divide Dublin in two, you know, because Dublin were so good. I'm not doing that with Limerick. And I'm thinking, if you said, right, Garrett Hegarty and Conor Neal, you can't pass the opposition 65 to stay within that zone. That's it. And then your six or eight defenders defend man to man. I think you'll see a greater, you know, equality of play, if you know what I mean. Because Limerick's tactics has been so strong. You know, I always talk about the middle eight, how they're so good at getting out through you. I'm nailing my colours to the mast. Go for it. Yeah. In the same breath, I'm screwing myself because Cathal Mannion is a roamer too.
Yeah, but you can let him roam and just leave another forward up at that point. It's just like teams got really good once they got used to the Gaelic football one about which players they were going to leave up and who would go back and who wouldn't go back. Yeah. And there were way more breaches in year one than you see now. So in year one, teams were still making the same mistake and they were funneling too many players back at the one time. Once the frees were given against it, the rule did exactly what the Football Review Committee wanted, which was to stop that from happening, that you would have 14, 15 men getting behind the ball. And then once teams got used to it, it meant that naturally you just left three players up all the time. I don't know. I'm not against it. I thought it was going to be very difficult to enforce at the start. And I thought, you know, woe betide any official who would turn around at some point and go, well, actually, your third forward came just inside the half at that point, and we're going to give you a kickable free up the other end. But the reality is that it actually did settle down and the officials got really good at spotting the breaches after a while. So even in a fast moving game like hurling, where, you know, the ball can travel quite a distance very, very quickly, I wouldn't be against trying it out. Like go on. What are you going to say with the Hooter? Go on.
I was just going to say, like, I watched the last, I suppose, 15, 20 minutes of Lough Derma. And, like, the last 2 seconds or 5 seconds when your man shot for the goal.
Yeah.
It was an awful mistake, and bless poor old Rafferty. But that kind of, you know, unknown, like, with the Hooter, created such excitement for a guy who's not a fan of football.
But, like, if you look at all the games, there's been no controversy in football since the Hooter came in, as far as I'm aware.
Why
like,
We wouldn't be talking about last week's game, Murph.
Not at all. Like, I saw people talking about it till Friday do you know what I mean? Like, I saw people talking about it till Friday.
Do you know, Murph, I almost fell for Mark Coleman because he was at the launch down in Blarney on Tuesday. And he's obviously had about 48 hours at that point for it to kind of, you know, settle down. All the conversation is still going. And nearly every question that he was asked was, what did James Owens tell you? Did you ask Sean Stack? You know, how aware were you? And he's basically going, look, we didn't ask him. James Owens went running up the other end of the field because he was anticipating the free being hit. Maybe we should have asked him. We didn't. He didn't tell us. Life goes on. It was almost like for Ben O'Connor, it was a much bigger issue in the immediate aftermath of the game than it felt like it was for the Cork players. But you're right. The discussion, because then Coleman says something, then there's reaction to what Coleman said, or people are on podcasts saying, oh, this is what they should have done. This is what they shouldn't have done. And we end up spending all week talking about the fact that there wasn't enough time for the two possessions.
Yeah, if bring a Hooter into that, and it's just a case that, like, you look at all the football matches that have been last gasp kind of points or whatever like that, the Hooter goes, and all you see is one team collapsing to the ground, disappointed, lost, the other celebrating, and nobody seems to be running at the ref. The only one was, let's say, was it the Connacht semi or the Ulster semi final where Monaghan were playing, and they were actually allowed to take the 2-pointer on the sideline because it had happened before the Hooter had sounded, so you're allowed to take it. So there's no ambiguity there, and they got it correct. But I just think that, and do you know what, actually, another one, I think they can bring the dissent one further. Like, I've noticed in football where you look at players now who are getting out of the way after they cause a foul because they don't want to bring the free up by 30 metres. So players are now hands up, running away, or handing the ball back, whatever. Like, there's been a whole cultural shift in football because that has been brought in. One of the things I notice now, even from back with club hurling, is that because the dissent thing now at the moment, and even dissent from the sideline, whereby if a supporter is mouthing, you can bring the free up. But that's what happened to us in the match, you know, whether or not it's meant to be happening.
That's not a rule.
Well, no, the thing was, you know what it was? They may have mistaken.
Was he a mentor?
No, it wasn't. It was literally a lad giving out a club match. It was a junior B match. But I think the man mistook him for one of the management because he was just sitting near the sideline, maybe. But the thing is that I notice players now on both sides not giving out to the referee because they know it's going to be moved up. So, like, I would actually take it a step further. If you look at rugby, I think rugby has the best way of it where one lad goes over and speaks to him. It's very tough, but if players know only one player can go over and anybody else, you're getting booked or you have to step away, it actually... I think the players are able to manage it a bit better. You get frustrated, but you contain it and you just go, okay, can't say anything. If you look at the World Cup now at the soccer, I hate seeing it now. And not because it's, I hate seeing poor referee, but I hate when like a lad hits the deck and suddenly there's 10 Colombian fellas around the referee pointing in his face. It's like we're wasting time here with the match. You shouldn't be over in his face. That frustrates me. And I think somewhere at the moment in hurling, we're somewhere in the middle where like we have the rules now that you can bring the ball up, etc. So players have like stood back a small bit, and the same with football. But I think where it is with rugby, whereby you never see rugby players culturally, you never see them going up and saying anything to the ref, rarely. Otherwise, you know, the referee will speak to them. But the captain's going up and approaching them. I just think it makes it a lot cleaner, you know. And I know people might disagree with it, but I think if you bring in that rule, people just adjust to it and you just go, I can't speak to the referee, I'm not the captain. And if you want to say, look, well, you know, what if your captain's corner back, he can't be going on the far end? Okay, have two people, have a back and a forward that's allowed to talk to the referee. Outside of that, everybody step away. Because I think it actually feeds into the frustration of players when, like, you frustrate yourself when you're shouting at a referee and you're not getting calls. I think it frustrates me as a player. Whereas if I know I can't shout at him, I automatically have to check my behaviour and calm it down a small bit. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense. But so I just think actually that's been good. And if we brought that in a little bit further, I think we could actually go as far as like two players from the team, you know, your centre back, your centre forward, whatever, pick two lads. They can only speak to the referee after that and then bring in the hooter and then nobody's shouting at the referee from then on.
You know? Doesn't it put responsibility on the player then, like?
That's it. Yeah, it should be.
At the moment now, there's a like, responsibility on the referee to maintain control.
Yeah.
The players never get blamed for throwing the referee. Whereas now I think if that was brought in, Murph, there's an element of self-policing.
Yeah, there is.
If I'm your teammate and you're shouting at the referee and it's the causation of bringing the free up, I'm going to get an arrest before I get on the referee's ass.
Exactly, that is it.
And you take, and that this will all be sorted in 6 months, one season, sorted.
Yeah.
Won't happen again.
Yeah.
So are we looking for, like I say, because I go back to you, I asked this 2 weeks ago about rule changes and you caught me on the spot. I said, no, our game is fine. But then the more I see the football, which I don't watch a lot, to be fair, so I'm only kind of really getting to see the benefit of the rules presently today. I'm like, geez, yeah, maybe we could look at this. Because football was in a poor state before the Rules Committee was developed, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. In certain instances, it was poor,
So this is
they've improved them. And there were people who were very, very resistant to these changes coming in. I think sometimes you need to give it a bit of time. I think hurling rule changes are inevitable, because on Tuesday I did the survey. I put the survey last week in, so hopefully everyone filled it out if they saw it on either the YouTube or on the Spotify when we shared it around. I did see some people criticising Mayo County Board. The Mayo County Board tweeted it out on Wednesday after the deadline had closed and kind of went, here's a developing county and a chance for people in that county to do it. You're spreading it after the deadline's actually closed. But what I found was it was heavily weighted towards potential rule changes, the survey, and less about the development of hurling. It definitely felt like it was engineering that conversation in that direction. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is a new hurling review committee or people brought onto the committee that they'll be talking about experimental rules for next season more so than, you know, the potential development in weaker counties. That's the feeling I got from filling out the survey. Yeah. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but I listened to Jim Gavin 2 weeks ago. He was asked about, you know, the changes the Football Review Committee had made, and he kept on speaking about the fact that they continued to go back to the survey results that they'd initially received and feedback that they'd received since. So I think they're going to take that feedback they got from the survey. They'll definitely look at all of it. I think they'll look at a lot of it, which is geared towards what would you like to change? What rule changes would you like to see? I'd be very surprised if we're not trialing things out in the league next year. So brace yourself for changes. And look, I'm not against it. I love this game. Don't get me wrong. But if people can find better ideas and someone says, hey, actually, if not passing them back to the goalkeeper is going to make puckouts more interesting, if allowing for, I don't know, I don't like the sideline one, but people keep bringing it up, 2 points for a sideline, so we encourage that skill. Whatever it might be, let's give it a lash and see.
Yeah.
Brave new world. Let's just embrace it and see what happens. Sometimes we clutch the pearls a bit too tightly when it comes to hurling and we think the hurling is perfect and it's not going to change. I don't think changing those rule changes is going to improve the game or spread the game or whatever else, but I'm also accepting that that is such a big issue and such a wide question that actually if this was to work, you can't just have Willie Mara doing it. Willie Mara would need a committee of probably 20 people all out on the ground doing things, not just him. Yeah. And that might be combining clubs. It was interesting because I remember we got sent the list of the clubs last week. I think I might reference it briefly with you guys. I definitely mentioned the hurling power rankings. I think there was only three counties where there were more hurling clubs than football clubs.
Mm.
And many of those counties were marginal in terms of how many more hurling clubs there were. And in other ones where it was reasonably 50-50, I think you'd have to count them as absolute dual counties. And then you have a host of counties where football completely dominates with the amount of clubs. That is a huge challenge. There's a lack of hurling clubs around, and there's a lack of hurling clubs around, particularly in the areas where the game has not traditionally developed. That is a huge task of work. Whether that be providing competitions, whether that be encouraging ways to start up new clubs. And I know last year Willie Maher was talking around those roadshows that he was doing that they had like 40 clubs or so, I think, had signed up at that point to begin hurling. But without, and I know Liam Griffin's motion never even got to Congress, but without the idea of, say, hurling being provided for very young underage teams in every club around the country, I think you're at a massive fight to try and get the interest levels up in areas where it's not traditional. This is like such a big issue. Survey is not going to solve that, unfortunately. No. I think we'd all say in the survey, God, I would love to see hurling played more throughout the country. I would love to see the creamy middle, those teams who are trying to catch the top 11 or 12 teams to get better. I would love to see those teams between about 12 and 6 get closer to the top 5 or 6 teams who feel like they're another maybe layer ahead. And we might talk about that this weekend as well. It's so complex. And there's kind of years, I would say, of neglect in many areas around the country, or a lack of desire maybe to grow hurling. It's not going to change overnight.
Is it gone too far? Is it even possible?
I don't know. To me, it seems very difficult. I don't know how you guys feel, but
I feel like there's, it's, you know, I'm not trying to be too downing here, but it seems like an impossible task. Because again, a friend of mine asked me about another province in Connacht, like, how do we get to your level? He's referencing Galway, and I'm saying, geez, man, it's a generational thing. Like, you have to start with literally 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, you know, get 1,000 children going in your county, and then hope that you end up with, you know, 30 class players in 20 years. That's really where you're at, you know what I mean? It's such a tough task to try and, you know, initiate in a county that's dominated by football, and let alone if that county is, you know, semi-successful at football. Not saying winner Ireland's, but being contested at the top table. So you take our province, you have Roscommon and Mayo, very hard to compete with that if you're trying to grow the game there. Same going to Leinster, Murphy, you can go up along within your own county. You know, it seems like I always say there's no correct answer. There's no exact science. There's no exact road to go down that if we do this, this will definitely work. It's knock on this door and see does that work. But the trouble is, you don't get the answer for 15 years. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like the Kildare model. You know, is the Kildare model the closest model to success, the road to success for developing hurling in a county where there's, you know, dominated by football? Is that fair to say?
I think it's a good blueprint, but I think you're looking again at a county that has advantages when it comes to population compared to maybe other places as well.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really difficult thing. Even with Kildare, it took a while for it to bear fruit. Yeah, like they were playing away in Kilkenny Underage Championships and Kilkenny League and stuff like that, and that took a while. And even still, Kildare's story could go backwards reasonably quickly. Like, we all celebrated them going up into Leinster, we celebrated going up to Division 1B. And at the same time, say if there's a bad run of results, will they still continue to bring hurlers through of the same level? Again, just because Offaly had a few good years at underage level doesn't necessarily mean that Offaly are back at that level again. Like, in the minor this year, they didn't progress into the knockout stages of the A Championship. So grand, they had a couple of good generations of players that got to under 20 in minor finals, but will it necessarily follow on beyond that? I'm not so sure. And in somewhere like Offaly, it's a little bit easier because at least you can tell the kids stories of their fathers, you know, uncles and so on were probably involved in teams in the 90s and so on. And it feels more attainable than it might in a county where there's just no tradition of it. So, it's a very, very difficult thing. I was looking at the weekend just gone by. And again, it's not to take away from anybody here, but like Tipperary have been excellent. And Woodlock has done a great job with a few underage teams in Tipperary now at this stage. But they have become the kind of standard bearers when it comes to underage in recent seasons with the minor success they've had and with the good runs they've had in the 20s. And they're only penalty shootout away from winning that 20s game against Clare in the Munster final this year as well. So they're bringing players through all the time. And they're one of the really elite counties. And they're all earning senior championships this year.
Again, are Tipperary bringing the players through? That's the question. It's their clubs.
They did 2 years ago. I know what you mean. Yeah. But what I mean is, as a county, they've got a conveyor belt of quality.
It happens in three fronts. So if I go back to Kildare for a moment, like, it goes to the importance and the power of having a really good manager in place. And I'm not throwing slight to David Herity. He did great work with him prior. But you need a top manager in place who's going to, you know, provide that kind of emphasis or even that, you know, motivation for players to join his squad, join his panel, because something good is happening, right? At the other end, you need clubs who are putting ferocious time into their youth and developing these players. So those Tipperary players, and every county alike, the clubs are doing all the work. You get a child at 5 years of age and you get him or her up to, you know, 17 with a giant Kilkenny or an Offaly panel. The club has put 11 years into that person. And then the county then just steer it from there on. Do you know what I mean? But that 11 years is of critical importance. So the clubs, if you look at the Tipperary structure, it's easy point to the Tipperary County Board and the Tipperary managers. And they have to win, of course they do. But whatever's happening in their club championships, their clubs, their schools, their national schools, that's probably a grander model we have to assess. Because you go further, we touched on it last week about the Munster versus Leinster conundrum we have at the moment. Munster are cleaning up everything. They're cleaning up everything. I think the only successful team I can think of, I stand to be corrected, lads, is probably St. Kieran's in Kilkenny with regards to schools. Everything else in underage hurling, in minors and 20s, over in the last team to win a 20s championship was Offaly, wasn't it, Will? And then Murphy was your uncle Kilkenny after that. But I was, who was talking to? I was talking to my uncle today, and we were talking about the last Leinster County was Galway, you could say, in 2017. And if you add up all the minors, 20s and senior championships that have been won in those 9 seasons, you know, of 27 potential champions, something like only 5 have gone to Leinster. You know, out of a possible 27, do you know what I mean? That's tipped way over. And it's not, you can't blame football, you can't blame rugby. I don't think you can blame population or numbers, obviously. So as when you talk about hurling, I know with the growth in smaller counties, but we have to go back into Leinster as well and keep the flag flying there as well.
Yeah, no, 100%. And like, this is what's happened. So the stronger continue to get stronger. Like, I think of that minor final now, it's going to be, you know, Limerick up against Tipperary again, which is a repeat of the Munster final when it came to that. The 20s this year, obviously, we had Galway against Clare, who happened the minor final from 3 years ago. But it's the same counties that continue to bring true strong groups of players. And again, we talk about maybe Clare, and I know we're going to talk about them coming up to this weekend, but even with some of their older players going, they have had a succession of good underage players over the last few seasons as well. So if you're trying to close that gap against those teams, we're talking about Tipperary and Clare, who both won in All-Ireland over the last couple of seasons. We know all about Limerick, and we know about the quality of college player, and even without winning much at underage in recent years in Limerick, they're still producing a high quality of player every year underage. You could have a generational group or two in a developing county, and it's nearly impossible to catch up with them, because it just feels like they're so far ahead now at this stage. And you know, for the rest of us, if Kilkenny are finding it hard to keep pace with these teams, what hope do the teams have that are maybe outside the top 6 or 7 in the country? I would say very, very difficult indeed. So that was it. Fill out the survey anyway. Let's see what happens. Let's see what the next steps are after that's happened. We did have a few people. I know Paul Breen was asking us to talk about the tackle. Look, I think the reality is the tackle is a mess. I was listening to Di Regan on Monday, and he made the fair point that James Owens was correctly calling tackles. But the problem is that if we get to a point where, while James Owens was correct pretty much across the board with the things he was blowing up, I don't know, Murph, if you want a game that's like that all the time, which is just free after free after free, the frustration of the game being pulled up all the time. I am not a let it flow merchant whereby everything should be allowed to happen. But the more I look at it, when I rewatch the Munster final, I can understand why people were frustrated. It didn't feel like that game ever properly got going. It was absorbing because it was close and it was entertaining and all that. But it's very, very difficult if all of these tackles are happening when they get called. It makes for also a terrible spectacle.
It does, yeah, and I think obviously when there's, you know, when there's a load of frees happening in any match, it's pointing towards some sort of a problem, either in discipline in players, or it's a case that something has crept in that we need to get out. And it is, it's probably, a lot of it then is the extra arm. It's that tackle that, you know, and again, it's strange. We didn't have any plans to say this, but in football, they've actually marshaled it very well, where, like, let's say players will predominantly tackle with the arm that's closest to the player, which obviously in football you have to do. You haven't got a hurl in your hand. But in hurling now, and you'll see it in club matches as well, it's where lads are pulling on a lad's arm. And some referees cop it and some referees don't. I wouldn't be too hard, obviously enough, and I know we're not being hard on any referee if they do call it. Because if they do call it, it is a foul. But it's probably pointing towards, and we obviously have a very rules-dominated conversation here for the first half hour, but it's probably pointing towards something that needs to be done within the rules that somehow provides something that allows flow to the game, but that the referee can also punish if needs be. Again, it's back on the players, really. Like, it's the players that are doing it. If the player's flowing, the referee has to call it. If there's a heap of frees during the match, how do we give out to a referee for that? Now, if a referee's going out and he's just whistle happy, you know, if he hears a clash of hurls and every clash of hurl is a free, that's wrong. That's, you know, not every clash of hurl is a foul. Whereas if it's a case where they're just looking at so many cases of a lad catches a ball, goes to break a tackle, and there's a lad hanging off his arm, he blows a free. Of course he has to blow a free there. So what the solution to that? It's a very new problem. That's the current, that's the thing. I think it just has to be a case of, if you look at, there's lots of rules that fall into the category of the hand pass. So now, like, okay, people will say they're not blowing all the hand passes, but they're blowing far more than they used to when it comes to this throwing hand pass. And you'll hear management and coaches saying to lads, be wary, make sure there's clear separation with the hand pass. And likewise, there's other rules. Likewise, the hand on the back. I mean, that you're teaching young lads that from juvenile age. Don't put the hand on the back, referee's going to blow it. I think it falls into that category whereby referees will have to blow it for a certain, you know, for maybe a championship or two championships. And lads will really have to, I suppose, feel the negative downsides to these frees going against them, being punished. Because make no mistake about it, after a game, if you have a stats team and a management looking through the game going, we lost that match by 2 points, where did we lose it? And they see floor frees that were put over the bar for a lad with an extra hand pulling in, to guarantee the management will be saying it to the team. So although in the moment, you know, it might be frustrating when you watch a match and see it, I think the referees do have to blow it, because I don't see another rule change that actually accommodates this and gets rid of it, because the rule change will be punish it. We are punishing it. We're trying to punish it. So I get what Dahi Regan's saying, but I only saw a brief snippet of what Dahi Regan was saying, and I think he was wrong in this, Will, that he did kind of defend his performance overall, and basically almost that he didn't blow anything incorrectly. Was that fair to say?
He said that James Owens had an excellent game. I think he used the word phenomenal at one stage as well.
He didn't have a phenomenal game. There was definitely instances, and I say Shane Barrett, and again, Shane Barrett went and looked for the free against Dermot Burns where he grabbed the arm and he went down. Some people might say, well, that's hard on James Owens to call. You need to recognise that when forward's going through. We spoke about it last week. Spoke about the one, Sean Finn, he got the free out when Connolly went in shoulder him. That wasn't a free out. Darrow Donovan's one, again, when there was dissent after and Jeremy Burns brought it up and put it over the bar. He didn't have a phenomenal game, and that's not us jumping on the back of him. We defended him last week where we said that he had no obligation to tell Cork about the free or that there was no play after this, as in, take your shot and that's it. So we defended him there, but I wouldn't call it phenomenal now either. But I do agree that the ones he called with the spare arm, I don't know how many he called, he has no other option in that situation. So I would defend referees quite strongly in that position, whereby if they're seeing an extra arm being used and players are shouting at them, it's the player's fault, it's not the referee. So, that's how I differentiate that performance there from James Owens.
Yeah, plenty of questions coming from the Spotify. You'll forgive us for this week for going a bit heavier on the pod questions, because we basically did all the YouTube questions last week, and I think we'll be back on the old YouTube after the quarterfinals next week. But Pete Lambert also sent us, and a few other people emailed me as well, but I'm going to give Pete credit here for this one, because he was the first one I saw it from, was the website which is called thereplay.ie. And this is after Tommy's appearance last week. And loads of people are saying, hey, get more special guests on. And look, I'm all for this over the next few weeks. Let's pop some friends of the pod on over the next while. But when Tommy Welch did this last week, he was telling us about how he loves me, all of my heart, the commentaries, listen, and kind of get in the mood when he's going to games and so on. And straight away, when I sent him this website, yup ya boya was the response that I got automatically from it. Murph sent it over to him. I think he said, I'm going straight to find, was it the 1988 final or something like that, straight away.
I think he went back and he listened to like the 84 final or something like this. But then he texted me about 3 hours later and he was like, geez, the 87 final is savage or something like that. It was one of the, I was like, what? Jesus. So he is getting use out of that now.
Straight to the centenary final, of course he would go. The last time that Offaly and Cork played in Championship in Semple Stadium, and Cork won that final, which sets us up nicely for this week. But what I liked about it as well is that it's a joint project. So it's the RTGAA and also the Alzheimer's Society as well. So it was set up originally, I think, for people who had dementia that wanted to go back and listen to Micheál's commentaries. That was the acorn of the idea of where it came from. And then it got a bit of funding, and it got funding from the RT Archives as well. And they started putting up pretty much all of Micheál's major games. So if you go onto it, you can search the game, or I think you can search by county as well on the website, and you can find whatever games are up there. So it's great to have all those in one place. I know Tommy is as happy as a pig in shit that is up there as well. So the replay.ie is the place to go. So yeah, really, really like that. And thanks to the people who emailed us during the week, and a couple of people emailed me with details about why the Alzheimer's Society got involved in it in the first place as well. So sounds to me like it's a really, really good project and a great idea. Lots of people saying, loving the legend that was Tommy, get him back on again. I'm sure we will get him on again, but I did enjoy how his phone mysteriously disappeared when we talked about the Kilkenny situation. Derek King's gone. Who should get the job, Tommy? Beep, beep. Beep, beep. And then a few days later, Tommy pops up as part of the minor management for Kilkenny for next season. So He obviously knew that was up for ratification as well.
I had a thought during the week where I was like, do you know what actually half the enjoyment, I think actually 90% of the enjoyment for the Tommy one was that there was no plan whatsoever to have him on. So the randomness of it. And I was thinking, would we have the possibility whereby if it was a case that I got onto some fella I know in the GA and I just didn't tell you, we have a plan that during Pod X, this person's going to jump on and I don't tell you who it is. And that'd it just... Would, can we try something like that?
We can,
I have to go off and try and use a contact and get him on the pod that week, him or her on the pod.
It'll be like the Tommy Tiernan show.
So we can bring on anyone.
Well, this is what I'm saying is like, we could dabble in it whereby we go off and we don't tell the other two. So let's say, for example, next week. We'll just
that's a fucking fantastic.
Doesn't it sound deadly? And like, lads at home, if you're live, right, and you're at home and we just stick the link on, because that's all we did with Tommy. You texted on, or no, I texted on to Tommy and I screenshot it and put it up during the week on Instagram. That's all it was, and Tommy jumped on, and I think the randomness of it is what makes it. Like
I do love the idea that down in the bottom corner, the first time you realise when someone's name. Johnny Pilkington has joined us. He was on with the two Johnnies this week, or whoever it might be. Andy Comerford has joined us to talk about us maybe slagging some of his ideas during the year. Oh look, it's D Fitz iPhone. Who's this?
I think it's a possibility. Is it?
I think it's a very strong possibility.
Right. A live pod.
I'm already added more. I'm going through people in my mind here.
I have someone in my head where I reckon I got him on. You wouldn't expect it. And it's not like a big, you know, that world famous fellow or anything like this, Hurling. Yeah. But I would like to hear this fella's opinion. So if we're going to do it, Will, just give me, I'm going to try. I don't even have this fella's number, but I just thought of him during the week. When I was thinking of this idea, I was like, I'd like to get that fella.
Now I want to know who it is. Jesus, more fight it to me.
No, but you got to keep it secret. The first I want to see is when they pop into the green room and we're just about to put them on.
That's exactly it. Where it's the name pops up and you're like, oh my God.
I presume you're not thinking of someone that we've had on before on this pod where we've never had, like, on, say, Flanagan on, or we've had Podge on or something like that.
No. Because obviously we have had the lads on before. And it'd be great to, like, I really enjoy the stuff the lads are doing, like Podge and Seamus. But I just think for the novelty of it, it's the randomness of, like, parachute someone into the middle of us and let's just get on with it and see what happens.
Million percent.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's the crack.
Okay. Let's do that this coming weekend. We'll be doing a live anyway, because Murph is going to be doing punditry on Clare against Dublin on Saturday.
Yeah.
Tommy Walsh is doing Sunday's game, which is the Cork Offaly game. So I think we can all be in place for Sunday afternoon for a pod after that game and have that person ready. Be like, hey, around 5 o'clock on Sunday. Just be ready for a text with a link.
Now, if he says no to me,
you have time to get someone else.
I'll let you know. I know. I'll just ring a few lads during the week. Say, listen, come on.
Scale, you're allowed of someone as well if you want.
Yeah, but I don't want to go within the hurling circle. I want to branch out further.
Well, I thought outside, and I was like, I thought of one or two, and I was like, it'd be interesting. Yeah,
because I have some fantastic characters that I know of and personally.
Yeah,
that the people, the listeners, would love, right?
Oh, yeah.
If I'm trying to tie it back to hurling, I could struggle. Well, I won't struggle. I guess hurling people no problem, but the characters I want to bring on, I put my name to.
Do you know who was brilliant? And I don't want to take, should I say, the time we were up in Capitagal anyway, Aidan Hart's father.
He was
brilliant.
He is fantastic.
Every so often, like, as in, I think when we have a dilemma like last week where people are saying, is it this, is it that with the free? I think you need to put Josie Hart on, like, national television and just say, Josie Hart says, lads, that's what's happening. Because he's so direct. I loved it. I was like, that's brilliant. So I just think this crack of, like, even myself being overly polite with, well, you should have done this and you should have done. Josie Hart, both barrels, again, the sawn off shotgun, bang. This is the crack. You made a ball switch.
And like, he just hasn't time for bullshit. He's just straight forward. Yeah. He's witty. Like, he won't catch
you. So funny. I always remember, and I drove home and I was laughing at it. I replayed it in my head several times. I can't remember if we said it, but remember we were doing the, so for context, obviously you had a fundraiser down the club, you had a marquee set up, and we went down and we did a show in the marquee, let's say.
Yeah.
But there had been boys, we're having points for the day. I'd say they were doing as much field day and now as we were, you know.
Yeah.
But there was one fella down the back and he asked a question and it just irked Josie. I remember Josie going, I invariably go to these things and there's one gobshite standing at the bar that asks the question. And he said, and we found him. I was like, this is brilliant. I was like, don't even ask us a question. Just let Josie talk.
Yeah. The tent raptured all night as well.
It was so good. Yeah, it was so good.
This one has come in from Adrian Noonan. is your name on Spotify. Two questions. Are Cork and Limerick holding the championship together? Has it been a bit drab so far? Lines up with Scales saying we reached a plateau, and Scales got wireless headphones on, so even when he walks away, he's still hearing this, so it's okay. That we reached a plateau over the last few years. We could have all these one-sided games until the final, potentially. So take number one. Both of you can take this. Has the season been a little bit drab so far?
I think in comparison to other years, it didn't hit the heights maybe at times of the other years, but I'm enjoying this championship. As a standalone, I'm enjoying it. I think sometimes people, and again, with hindsight and with nostalgia, you think the other years, every year is going to be like that. Some years teams just fail to hit the pitch. And maybe this year we've seen a few of those. But on the flip side, the Leinster Championship has been better than it has been in the last, would you say, 10 years across the board. I'm not just saying some people might towards Wexford's win in 2019, that was brilliant. That really, checked the whole thing. But across the board, Offaly getting out, Kilkenny not getting out, Dublin getting to a Leinster final, but topping the table, but Galway beating them. I just think, and in Kildare, okay, they didn't get any points, but they really show that coming up from the Joe McDonagh, there's a chance that you can lay hands on teams if you're some way set up, but they were just lacking that bit of quality.
Entertainment-wise, 100% is the best one since 2019.
Yeah, it is. I think even including 2019, 2019 was exciting.
That had a good end to the group stage as well, and obviously Wexford win a crack and final, all that type of stuff.
Yes,
that was a good
one. That's true. But I think we're probably always, at the moment in the hurling world, we pitch everything against how good Munster is. If Munster is maybe a little bit middle of the road, and I think maybe the fact that Tipperary didn't hit the peaks they hit last year, not even just getting out of Munster, but just putting pressure in terms of getting out, and Waterford then as well. Quite a lot of it was decided by, would I say, definitely into match three, we knew at that stage, really, didn't we? Or round three. But I'm enjoying this championship. And I know some people might be saying, this is the problem. And invariably each week in the comments, I think we see it where lads are saying, the game is gone. And this, I'm enjoying it. And like I said, even for the Munster final itself, I don't mind when there's flaws in it. I don't mind when there's mistakes made. I think it actually adds to the whole entertainment of it. But It maybe hasn't hit the heights of other years, but we have some distance to go yet. We have the quarterfinals this weekend. Last year, the quarterfinals threw up Dublin beating Limerick. I think this weekend it's going to be hard, and I know we're going to get into it, for Offaly to lay a hand on Cork, because Cork are just at such a standard at the moment. They're number two in the country, really. Clare and Dublin has the potential, and for me, it's a case of if Dublin turn up, and if that turns up, we have a great match, and then we have a great semi-final then as well. We certainly have a great run into a semi-final if that turns out to be a good match.
Yeah, memory can be a dangerous thing. I remember this time last year, we had the podcast this week, which is just off the preliminary quarterfinals, and our first instinct was Limerick are going to go through Dublin. This is Limerick now getting back after the 2 weeks before they'd lost the Munster final on penalties, and they were going to get back to Croke Park and be impossible to beat, and then we get the shock of the century. I think many of us were kind of expecting what happened in the other quarterfinal, and we were very down, I think, on that weekend going into it. So, you can be really, you can be unfair in your memory of how you were in the last few years as well. There's often been times where we were lining up hypothetical semi-finals and finals, and then they don't necessarily happen. So, I still think if we get to semi-finals and it's that derby eventually that we get very rarely between Galway and we could get Galway, Cork and Clare Limerick. That's the way it's going to fall, isn't it? Yeah. So that would be tasty. We get Galway, Cork, and then we're back at another derby between Limerick and Clare. Magic. But at the same time, if Dublin are awfully turned them over, next thing we've got this intriguing story at the weekend just to come. So let's not write this weekend off entirely before we do our predictions in a little bit. What's your overall feeling about the season then, Skell? And I am always mindful of us doing season appraisals when there's still, games to go here.
Yeah, we've had 27 games so far this year between the both championships, finals inclusive, Will. And I think, to be honest, you can only take one or two that have been genuinely really exciting. Mm. When I say exciting, I'm thinking it has everything. It has a great contest between both teams. It has free flow and hurling provided by the referee. It has quality throughout. It has great weather conditions where the fans can get involved and come out in their droves. And maybe I'm guilty myself of my own memory, but I just think the game nearly reached a pinnacle between the years of 2021, 2024. I think that those 4 or 5 seasons, I do agree more of the Munster Championship provided an awful lot of that entertainment. But even when you go to the semi-finals with Clare, Kilkenny and these games, they were just magic. You know, I don't think it has taken off, but I think we're guilty as well. And I'm certainly guilty, whereby I'm always comparing seasons to seasons just gone. So it's current season to season just gone. And look at this season going, yes, it's been entertaining, but the quality that we've seen and the quality of contest and the tightness of contest is not what it once was before. You know, maybe, and when I say it was before, I'm talking very recent memory in the last couple of years. And it brings me right back to championship games where you have Clare Kilkenny, you know, you've got the Clare Cork final. I don't have to say the years. I think people will know what I mean when I don't say the years. You've got the Limerick and Clare, you know, nearly trilogies that went on in Munster year in, year out.
You're almost spoiled sometimes, though, as well, Scott. Remember the first weekend of Munster 2 years ago, with two draws on the first day, and you're just like, this is going to be the most unbelievable championship of all time.
Yeah, I was just coming to that, like, and there was a phrase that just be thrown around sometimes about the hurling snobbery. You know, and again, I myself am guilty of that, whereby I just think we have the best game in the world, but the product itself that was produced in, you know, 2021, 2024 was so good that it's like you're trying to get to that level once more. And it's not like when you watch a favourite film, Will, and next thing there's a sequel comes out, and the sequel doesn't quite match the excitement of the original. Like, oh, damn it, would you want it to be so much better? But just that's what the players have produced, I think, in years gone by. Both Leinster and Munster, I have to say, that what we've seen has been really revolutionary. The game where I think that, honestly, between 2021 and 2024, where the game reached a point whereby it was just, you know, it was insurmountable at the quality that was on show from every player. And like every player was producing a level of skill, strength, physique. We talk about the tackle morph, like players have gone so strong, they're mad to use their physique, you know, in the games, the shooting efficiency, the distances, the saves, you name it. It just got to a level whereby there were surprises every day. Every day there were surprises about what a teams could produce and the excitement that could produce, added with the commentary that we were able to add in, speak about. So this year, I don't call it, it's not drab, it's not, but I just, you're kind of waiting for it to take off. And like I did the count as Murph was talking. There's 27 games played so far in the provincial championships. There's 5 games left, you know, over the course of the championships. So we've reached, you know, near the pinnacle of the, or the end of the championship. You're saying there's 5 games left to save the season. And when I say save the season, you know what I mean. Take it with a pinch of salt. I'm not saying the season has been terrible, but like we're waiting for this to take off. And I'm hopeful it does. But I'll be honest, I'm not trying to get predictions early doors, but next week's games, I can't see those games being the two games that'll save the season, per se.
No.
I think it's going to come down to the last three.
No, I think you're right. And I think, look, we've seen some snippets here and there of what could happen. Like, I think of that Cork play before the Nicky Quaid save in the first half of the weekend just gone by, and you're just going, even in difficult conditions, look at how slick this hurling was. Look at that incredible save that's been made by the goalkeeper at the end of it. More of that. And we had a few one-sided games in Munster. I think that affects our memory of this year's Munster Championship as well. We've got so used to those games being so competitive that when we've double-digit scorelines in quite a few of the games this season, that makes it feel a bit like a damn squib. And I think even, I'm guilty of this too. I thought Tipperary against Clare was going to be an absolute cracker a few Saturdays ago. I was sure of it. You know, teams fighting for their lives. And then Clare win it quite handsomely. And as much as that's a fantastic result for Clare, for the neutral, you're like, I just wish that game had been a bit closer. And maybe that's because I built it up in my head.
Yeah.
Can I
ask you guys a question?
Go for it.
I would class myself as having a fairly good memory for like probably the last 30 years, even though I'm 38. So like, so in terms of games, like
this is why he's going to love that spin the wheel game. Again, I'll stick it into the comments. He's going to love this.
But I'm coming to the point whereby, again, this is part of my hurling snobbery, where I'm talking about goalkeepers and the saves they're making nowadays. It feels like goalkeepers are making 5 saves a game, 4 saves a game. Go back now into the like late 90s, early 2000s. Were goalkeepers, like, in my mind, making 1 save a game? Was even getting through?
I remember certain games, and like, again, this is my nostalgia as a young fella. There used to be great days when the 2 semi-finals, Leinster semi-finals, used to be in Croke Park, and you'd have a variety of, you know, Kilkenny-Wexford and Dublin and Offaly or something like that. And the odd year there, I think Kildare were in it and so on. But I remember like going to matches, and definitely like Damien Fitzhenry sticks in my head as like pulling off 2 or 3 diving saves or something to that effect. You think back there, 2002 semi-final where Brendan Cummins, remember that one against Tommy? So he stopped 3 shots against Tommy. Like, you think about that, was 3 saves in a goal. And that's 2002. And there was probably other saves in that.
Can I count to that for a moment, right?
Absolutely.
Go back to all the goalkeepers that have played, and whether it be, you know, Hennessy, Murray, James McGarry, PG Ryan, let's say, I can only ever remember PG Ryan making 1 or 2 diving saves. Do you know what I mean? James McGarry, I can't remember James McGarry making a diving save.
2009 Ireland final, James
Cannon.
But PJ Ryan was man the match in that. He pulled off
He pulled off the one right. He saved to his left, James Cannon went there.
Yeah.
My point being is, right, Nicky Quaid, I'd say, has made 50 saves. Or Murphy has made 50 saves, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the point being is, it's far more prominent now where I see goalkeepers getting tested, whereby I think James McGarity was nearly a victim of his defence's success.
There definitely was a stage for McGarry, because McGarry, I don't think, won an All-Star in the end, but it was almost under the fact that he was absolutely at the peak where Kilkenny were blowing lads out of the Leinster Championship and winning by 20 points. And
he just wasn't busy enough.
He wasn't busy enough. And that can be a thing just with goalkeepers, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, you know, whereas in the same match, a forward might put himself on for hurler of the year and the goalkeeper down far and keeps a clean sheet. But, oh no, your backs were so good, you know. So it's... That's the tricky thing, as well you would know, with goalkeeping. It's where, when you're not busy, it's great in one way, but you're not really showing what you can do as well. You know,
I suppose the grander point I'm trying to make is, first, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to goalkeepers in the past, right? And not sure that's PJ Ryan. I know he got man of the match that year, but I just think that the quality of play the teams are developing nowadays is so, you know, high, and they can open you up. They can open defenses up through slickness and great passing and extreme athleticism that goalkeepers have been called upon far more.
I honestly
if I was to go back through it since Nicky was started in goals, I'd say he's made, not joking, less 100 saves.
Do
you know what I mean? And of all types of quality, same with Ron Murphy. Like, his hips must be screwed for all the diving he's had to do in his back, you know. What I'm saying.
But our expectation of the type of saves has changed as well, though. Like, I remember after that Munster final last week when Quaid makes that incredible diving save, and it was like, Donalogue basically used the old mantra, which was, it's a good height for a goalkeeper. You're just kind of thinking, if this had been 10 years ago, this is a highlight in and of itself coming out of the game.
Yeah, completely.
Now we kind of expect him to save them.
Well,
Teacher Cahard often bring out the top 10, you know, they do the clean, the lean, but they also had the top 10 saves of nearly the last 30 years, right? And the 10 saves they show are, you know, from the late early 2000s into the kind of the early 10s. And if those saves were made nowadays, they wouldn't make the top 50. That's how high quality the goalkeepers are producing saves at the moment. Like, it's just like, it's abnormal. And that goes back to my grander point about the snobbery that we're all guilty of, I think, at the moment, where we see the game is at such a high level that we expect it day in, day out. And if we don't see that day in, day out, well, fuck it, something wrong. Something's very wrong. Do you know, like, what's going on? These lads aren't producing the quality. 40 lashes.
Yeah, you love your 40 lashes. Look, I think it's been a good year, though, for saves, given that Mark Sheedy, the Clare under 20 goalkeeper, ends up on ESPN's Play of the Week on SportsCentre for the save in the penalty shootout. We talk about some of the Billy Nolan saves. We've talked about some of Nicky's saves. It's just been unbelievable this year. We're giving love to what's happening between the sticks, I think, at least on this podcast, and our good compatriots over on ESPN as well. Part two of the question, then. Do Cork have a real issue now with finals, more so the group of players currently with the two All-Irelands League and Munster final this year, not taken away from last year's Munster, but it was penalties. Do you believe they can actually win these big days? Also coming from Adrian. Look, there's no taking away from this. I think it's the 1-8 total from play in those last two finals in the second halves. That's an issue. That's the same group of players. And to use a Taylor Swift, it's like, it feels like I've seen this movie before when it comes to Cork fading out of finals. The only way, I think, and see what you boys think about this, for them to put that to bed is for it to not to happen the next time they get to a final.
Yeah. Completely. I think
it has to be a concern, though. Two big finals in a row now.
But can we narrow it down a bit?
Go on, narrow by all means.
I'm interested to see more perception. I'm really interested to get the other perspective. Like, is it the public and we will talk about the finals as a whole. We're just talking about the finals, had an issue in finals. But can we talk about what happens? What traits does that team have? What characteristics do certain players have in those moments, let's say? So when Clare Cork couldn't get beyond the goal they scored last week, what's happening? Is their defence faltering? Is the kind of ball going into it? Can they win the puck out? Is the forwards not winning 1-1? I'd be very interested enough to see, what do you think is happening? Because I have an idea in my head, and I don't like to see it to the line. So was it the opposition? Did they stem them? And so on. You get the basis of my question.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Like, for me, when I look back at it, I didn't notice in the time that that Cork hadn't scored from play from 38 minutes until, you know, we saw it trashed out in the stats after the game. So at the time when I was watching it, I wasn't automatically saying to myself, this is what needs to happen. But in that time, for me, one of the fundamental things, and it's not a statistic-related piece of information, it's a leadership element whereby, for me, I'd be thinking a player needs to stand up. It comes back to kind of brass tacks hurling. You need someone to stand up, get a ball, pop it over the bar, and basically start providing answers for players on the field. I think at times, like if you look back at the 2025, and this might match up with what you think, Skell, it doesn't mean I'm right either, but you look back at the 2025 final, when things start to go wrong for Cork, where are the answers coming from? There didn't seem to be answers on the field, whereby someone is standing up, getting the ball and going, this is what we're doing, driving on. And a score is very settling in those situations where someone gets a ball and pops it over and suddenly you feel a calm. And then you feel the energy coming back from the crowd and you go, okay, another player wins a ball. And you put together a few pieces of play and you go, right, we're back in it now. But I don't see Cork kind of doing that because, you know, after 38 minutes, they didn't put together a piece of play whereby they put the ball over the bar. So that to me says that, A, someone needed to stand up and grab a ball and put it over. And then the rest of the team follow then from that where they collectively they go, okay, right, we're back in this and off we go. If you look at 25 in the final, at no stage that happened in the second half. You look again against Limerick in the Munster final, I go, where was that? It just wasn't present. Because, Will, when you ask the question of can they do it, I think they're so close to doing it. They're just right there. But it's a case of I don't even think it's a tactical thing. It's a mentality thing. It's a spirit thing. It's a leadership thing, whereby you just need someone to grab a ball and drive forward. It doesn't even have to be the full forward. It doesn't have to be the centre forward. It's one lad grabbing it, driving forward. You think about the likes of Kieran Carey in the Munster final back in 96?
This is 95, the one where he runs 95. All the way up the field. Yeah.
Do you know that type of play where someone like goes, I'm taking this ball and I'm going up, and suddenly lads go, right, yes, we're back in this now and we're going for it. That to me was the one thing, and I motor lads might be saying, that's bullshit, you're miles off. But for me, when I look at the overall, why aren't Cork doing it? Like you look back at then when Clare beat them, they were up by 6 or 7 points in 24 and they could have drove on. And there was just that, okay, give Clare the credit, came back into it. But it was there in front of them to grab it by the scruff of the neck and drive on. They've fantastic quality all over the field. But I just think that leadership element where, you know, one fella provides a bit of answer and then suddenly two or three are providing answers and now the collective are performing. I feel there's something there.
Yeah, sorry, Kerry was 96. As I recall, that's when Joe Quaid basically had to carry him out of the showers because his feet were so gone because he was wearing the wrong studs on the warm day.
But sorry, Skell, you go ahead.
I think I would have disliked to hear something about maybe a tactic where it's all down to the mentality and energy morph, right? I think Cork really struggled to shift energy when things go against them. So if you look at their, let's say, minute 67 to 70 the last day against Limerick, they lost the four puck outs that was in that space of time. That's where Limerick overtook them. And they're missing this opportunism that's created by their own players to win a big puck out. The Hegarty's of this world, give me the ball, I win the puck out. So it's an energy shift. So when they go well, right, it's very hard to take the energy back off Cork because they're all partaking in this energy, right? It's very hard to stop them. It's so hard to stop them because they're flying every which way, things are moving well, and there's no kind of blockade in front of them. When the blockade is provided to them and the opposition gets a bit of, you know, I suppose a proper patch, it's Cork find it so hard to get the energy back, right? And that's why you see teams will just, they'll get like real proper patches, real moments of dominance in like a 5 minute spell or 10 minute spell against them, and you look around to the Cork team and say, where's the answer going to come from to stop this and get the energy back? And so when we talk about Fitzgibbon and Brian Hayes and Rob Downey, I always say about those three guys, they're the guys that will generate this energy for Cork, right? And so it's so hard to see how it doesn't materialize for them. And sometimes this energy could be a big tackle, it could be a puck out win, it could be just offering a lung busting run to get a 1 point. That's all it is. Next thing you shift it all back, and I think the issue now is far grander in the Cork mindset than we think, to be honest.
Yes. Because
we can practice, I can practice against the ball one more. I can run up and down the pitch. I can have shots saved on me all the time, right? But to practice those moments in big games, right, it's very hard to recreate those in training. And it's down to the player or the individual, or the person, in conjunction with a Carlin Kerr type person, to assist you on how to pull back the energy, right? Because it's a fucking it's a terrible force to try and stop. And in fairness, Murph, you were fantastic at it in your pump, whereby you'd start off like playing to Kinney. You'd start off, you'd put in a fantastic 50 minutes and you're there and you're winning by a point or two, but you can just feel this black and amber wave coming. You're saying, how do we stop it? And there were times where we just didn't have the clientele, first of all, and then the mental fortitude to stop it. And I think that Cork now at the moment have the clientele at their disposal, but it's that last 5%. That last 5 or 10% whereby to win a big moment, to shift in energy, to get the crowd back on your side, to nullify the opposition, they just don't have it at the moment. And when I say don't have it, they have to make it happen. So they'll have it when it happens. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, yeah, Yeah.
So
yeah.
They go out now, if they play, let's say, in an Ireland final, and that moment whereby you can point towards, that's where the victory was got. It was a big puck out. It was a run, you know, a simple run, got a point over, turned the tide. That's what they, and I think that's where they're struggling at the moment, genuinely. I don't think it's tactical. I don't think it's not fitness, it's not strength, it's not lack of skill or preparation or finance, you name it.
Yeah.
You can find any amount of reasons, or the fucking referee playing too much. It's not that. It's just there was 4 or 5 minutes there where the team was crying out for big leadership, for a big moment to shoot, get the energy back away from Limerick, not allow them to get in front. That's where they fell down.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I remember one a few years ago. It was, and it wasn't even in, let's say, but that big of a match, but I think it was 2018. We played Dublin in Parnell Park, and I was actually subbed the same day. I'd only come back from overseas, so I'd only been back in the country, I say, 4 or 5 weeks at this stage. And I was a sub starting that day, or so a sub when the match started that day against Dublin. And I was about, Dublin were up at halftime, I think, but into the second half, Dublin were up by 5 points. And I was told, start warming up there, you're coming on. And I think Liam Rush got a goal and went up by about 8 points. And I think there was 15 minutes left on the clock, or 20 minutes left. And Cody called me, anyway, come down, you're going on. And I went down, and I expected some kind of a, listen, right, we want you to sit, we want you to do this. And like, cornerback my whole career. And he goes, you're going left half back. So he didn't give me any tactics. He just said, you're going left half back, get out there and fucking take charge. Because it was just a thing where lads weren't moving towards the Dublin goal. Lads weren't going attacking ball or whatever. And I remember then just kind of going, okay, yeah, grand. And I just went out, and it was none of this kind of tactics gone out the window, because tactics can cloud your brain a little bit at a time, where you really just need to bring it back to, I'm going out to win the ball, I'm going to drive forward with the ball, I'm going to make a play happen. And I remember I just running out, grabbing balls and just running forward, or grabbing balls and just driving forward. And I'm not saying it was because of me, but they're like, TJ got in the ball, and Park Wilch got in the ball. And suddenly there was a shift. And it was that word that you said, Skell, there was a shift of momentum where we started to claw back at them. And then we got a goal. Liam Blanchfield got a goal. We ended up by 3. And we ended up beating by 3 points in the end. So we went for an 11-point swing. But I always think in that moment, just Cody knowing that it was a case where, this isn't tactical. This is boys just needing to grab the game and actually take it to a team. And I always just remember that moment going, God, that was actually, I'd say it was clever out of him. But and maybe other lads will say, well, maybe he didn't have a tactic to play at the time. But that was a big learning curve for me, where I just went, okay, sometimes. And do you know what's another one? Do you know another example I give is, think back during COVID there, where Liam Sheedy was managing Tipperary. I'm very sure it was during COVID, because there was a water break during it. I remember that play.
His how he reacts to different players. Yeah.
Great. I think it was Bubbles' arm around the shoulder. I think it was Bubbles' arm around the shoulder. And then Calvin comes in, he hits him back to the ribs. Yeah. And it was that thing of, like, he knew that, like, he'd grow one player, and it was the leadership he was looking for there. That wasn't tactical. It wasn't anything. That was just getting something into a player. And when I look at Dublin and Galway match, I was listening to Darren Maloney say, oh, Dublin need a spark here, they need a spark. But what I was looking at is going, I can't see what player is taking this to Galway. Like, so that was similar to what we're saying with Cork not scoring for 38 minutes to 70. I was looking to see, well, where is the lad grabbing this with the scruff of the neck? Whereas when Dublin scored 1-4 to Galway's 1 point, and they come back within a point of them, I see Conor Whelan coming out, grabbing a ball and putting it over the bar and killing it and stemming the tide, and now retaking that momentum, retaking, I suppose, the swing of momentum that went on there. And those are things which they're very hard to pick out during a game. But if you can see them, or you can see the lack thereof of that, then you know there's a leadership thing there. And I temper all that by saying I don't think that there's not leaders within that Cork panel. I think when Darragh Fitzgibbon is not there, there's a huge leader missing, you know. And I think this is a conversation you could have a big, you talk about for hours. But one of the other one good examples I would give is, I think when Limerick Beckel Kenny in 23, I have visions of Dermot Burns coming out with a ball where he made a big play. The game was still in the jaws. He made a big play. He caught it. He was fouled, and he stood out at he jumped up from the foul and kind of just, you know, gave a kind of a fist pump. It was defiant. But for me, I remember sitting in the crowd going, ah, I can feel that momentum now going with Limerick, because Dermot Burns made a big play. You know, this game is up for grabs. And Dermot Burns came out and said, I'm taking this ball. And I remember as a Kilkenny lad, I went, oh, that's a big one now. That is big. It's 90 scores on the board, but that's a message of intent. So, yeah, long-winded answer there.
No, the one that always reminds me is the Rock O'Sullivan coming out and just bounces off a couple of defenders and then puts it over the bar. And you're like,
that's for 3 points.
It's that moment where you're like, right, he's going to drive it on. and we're going to drive it on for him from here. It's a lift for everybody when that happens. So let's see if Cork have that leadership starting with this game, which is the quarterfinal on Sunday afternoon. We were wondering about the record that Dublin had at Thurles, and thankfully we had a couple of listeners who gave us a breakdown of what they've done. So pointed out by Neil Carney that Dublin actually beat Limerick and Thurles 11-15, but those results in 11-15 are the two wins from 10. James Buckley put the full record up on our comments last week. They've lost the last five times they've gone to Semple Stadium in Championship, and those two victories against Limerick are the only two they have in the last 10 at Semple Stadium. So, yeah, it's a tricky one. And they've got recent memories, obviously, of losing against a Munster team when they've gone down there in recent times as well. We'll get into those games in 2 seconds, but I just want to chat about the managers who've just gone. So, one, I think, was probably a little bit less expected than the other, Murph. And the one that was probably a little bit less expected was Peter Queeley in Waterford. So he sent us on a statement during the week, and I was reading it, and he said he was very disappointed because he felt he didn't have the full support of the county board. He felt he should have been kept on after these couple of seasons he's had. First year obviously goes quite well in terms of they come up from Division 1B, they go into 1A. Okay, they don't get out of Munster in either season. They've gone back down. But our kind of feeling was that Waterford, we saw some signs of progress from what they did this year. Was there an argument that Queeley should have been given a third season?
I would have definitely given him a third season, to be honest. I really like Peter Queeley as a manager. I know we would have disagreed where he felt that the format of Championship should change, and we were saying that, well, you know, if you're not winning matches, you can't be expecting to leave Munster. But that aside, I think that Waterford did progress underneath him. I think that I think he really approached the job in a very earnest way and really tried to bring Waterford back to a style of hurling that they can play and be effective playing. And I don't think he was a million miles away. Like, I mean, during the league, I was looking at Waterford going, do you know what? These are, like, given that he has a year under the belt, you know, he's really starting to put shape on this team, and you can't expect the manager to come in and just be successful the first year. I really do think you need 2 or 3 years, and you need to trust the process. And I really thought Waterford were heading in a good direction. I would have thought that there was no reason why Peter Queeley shouldn't have been there next year. And I was very surprised. Like, if you were to tell me about the managers that you think might have stepped away, after I saw Keith Roster talking, thought, okay, that sounds, even after I heard Derek talking in Parnell Park, said, okay, maybe Davey and Antrim, you were thinking, okay, this is most likely going to move on. But I didn't expect Peter Queeley. And I think with the job he's after doing, I think it would have benefited Waterford a lot more if he stayed in the job for another year, because I think they were headed in the right direction. And even if it was the case, like, where next year, if they got out of Munster under his tenure, well, that would have been measurable progress for Waterford. And I think he was capable of that as well. So, I think it's, now again, maybe Waterford County Board or whoever know better than me, but I really liked the cut of Peter Queeley, and I think the next manager has a tough job again, because you're starting kind of from scratch again. But yeah, I think that's disappointing. I think a good few Waterford people would be disappointed to see him go as well.
Yeah. The feeling I've got from Waterford friends I've spoken to, Skeller, maybe the county board have someone lined up already. And maybe that was part of the reason that there wasn't full backing. But they were surprised that when Queeley very much actively wanted to stay on, that he wasn't given the chance to stay in position.
I agree. Like, I thought, first of all, I think there was what Peter Queeley brought was quite a calming presence and a bit of reassurance to the Waterford public and to the players alike. I thought he was very, you know, straightforward. Even his interviews, I liked the way he speaks. He was honest. It was accountability versus blame. So he was always very accountable of himself. Obviously, he would keep comment on certain moments in games with referees, as every manager does. But there was always a feeling was that it was Waterford is what he held best at heart. Mm-hmm. And that Waterford were extremely competitive. And, like, he's dealt a tough hand as well, like, with players who were absent through choice, and also absent through injury. Like, so I think what they produced this year, I think, was very admirable. Like, when all things considered, you know. And, like, I know the public might think we were harsh on Waterford with regards to their position in Munster, but that was just the sad reality of where they were and what they were producing. But as a whole, versus what they were doing 3 years ago versus what they did today, I think it was an improvement, and it was kind of on the right road, you know. So I was very surprised. I thought, if you asked me of all the management positions to be, you know, in question at the end of the year, I didn't think Waterford would be one, hands in hand. I thought that to be a straight shooter, keep going, that they have, like, they have clarity as a county, as a board, as a playing group, and keep moving and see where next year and the year after takes you. Because he's not exactly being fed with conveyor belts of talent that he can maneuver. Like, he's been dealt a very tough hand. So to kind of not get the full back, and I don't quite understand it. Maybe there's something in the background that, you know, that we don't know. that the Waterford County Board do know that's going to change the tide for Waterford Hurling. But when you say that they might have the candidate in mind, I can't think of anyone in Waterford circles that would, you know, bar Derek McGrath, who maybe is held in very high regard still in Waterford. I can't think of anybody. I can't think of nobody, let's say, who could put their hand up. Even the greats, let's say, who've tried their hand in underage hurling in Waterford, the Ken McGraths, Milans, Joe Kelly. Like, I think I'd say if you asked London guys, they're behind Peter Queeley. Very surprising decision for me. I'm sure we'd hear more, or we mightn't either, Jesus, in the coming weeks or months. But like, I'm sad to see him go. Mm. You know, for what he's done, because management positions are very, very hard. And you know, the choice you as a county board and as an executive, who you put in or you vote in or who you accept or put in as manager, has a huge effect on that team, that county's performance, you know, for years going forward. And like, I made the reference here about external managers taking over counties. You know, I'm not a huge favourite, but I just see in my own county what bringing Micheál back. And I was a very big advocate for that, you know, the year previous, to get Micheál back, because you knew what he could do. So you see the skills that a manager can bring back to a county. And same with O'Kellicon in Dublin. And there's more to come there too, but I just think when you get someone that's you know, very well accepted, the public, he's endearing to players and to the public, you've got to keep him and keep him moving forward and see where it takes you. So, sorry for that one.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because obviously Dan Shannon has generally been the number two. He's been like the assistant manager, the head coach, everyone will look view him as, with both Derek and now this run recently with Peter Queeley as well. They have gone outside recently, you know, with both Davey and with Liam Cowell. Do they go back outside again? I'm very mindful, obviously, if you were to go, sometimes it's the best manager with the best club team. Ballygunner had been managed by Jason Ryan over the last few years. Is he the guy that they'd want to bring in? I don't know. A lot of questions, I would say, over the next while. I heard some people kind of linking Pat Ryan, if he was potentially interested.
It's too soon after he left the job. Like, I mean, if you're leaving a job, I think maybe some lads, you know, just want to get back into a job like that. But
it's tough to go to your neighbouring county as well, where you know you're going to be in a rivalry in the championship as well.
But it's tough, like, I mean, inter-county management, it's such an undertaking to take in. The fact that, and then you add the journey onto it, that he'll, you know, he left a job where he's driving, I don't know how far Pat Ryan drives to Cork for training, but I imagine he's a hell of a lot closer than he is to Welsh Park or to Ardnor or wherever they train, wherever Waterford train. So,
isn't it like holding a position of politics? Inter-county management, it's like being a politician. Half the place think you're an asshole, the other half like what you're doing. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like you're never going to win. You know, it's a very hard place to occupy.
It's 100% a job, I think, as well, where you start off with great goodwill across the board, but invariably, however good you are, even if you deliver all Ireland, you will have people who just decide eventually someday you're not good enough. And even regardless of what you've done previously. So if I'm sure a lot of lads accept that before they go into the job and they understand it and they don't care, nor should they. But I just think it's such a tough job where you know you're taking it on, that at the end of it, you're going to have couple of thousand people that think you're, you know, X, Y, and Z, and that's tough for a lad who's a volunteer, you know, in most cases a volunteer. Yes.
Yeah. It's also an unusual situation where you've got three teams now in the same area, effectively a southeast sweep of management vacancies at the same time. So Kilkenny have begun their search. I think I was reading during the week that they're asking the clubs now to put in submissions. Waterford now looking for a manager, and Wexford similarly with Keith Rosser leaving. You would think that a lot of the people who might be interested in those jobs might be all from the same area as well, potentially. So just on Keith Rosser, I don't get any great surprise here, Skell, given that, you know, I listened to his comments after a few of the games in the Leinster Championship this year. To me, it felt like he was a guy who knew they weren't going to get out of Leinster with the way things were going, and B, it felt like he'd come towards the end of the road. No different read to Derek Ling. I remember reading his comments after the Offaly game. It almost felt like he said, look, this decision I have to take now in conjunction with my family. They're missing their dad being around as much as I normally would be. And I got the feeling with Rosser, unlike Queeley, where he'd had his three seasons with the team, had been with the 20s, would have been there as selector at the tail end of Davey as well, that it felt like for Keith Rosser, who's had an incredible playing career and has been involved as selector manager for a long time now at Wexford, he felt it was the time to leave.
I think rightfully so. I think I'm often assessing managers' body language on the sideline and interviews after, and it just looked like that the way Wexford's year kind of, you know, petered out, and his own body language says that I've enough of this. You know what I mean? I don't mean it in as drastic as that, but like he's given more than Derek Ling when Murph said he offered nearly the best part of 3 decades of service to Kilkenny in every capacity. Keith Rosser's done the same. So I think the Wexford public as a whole, I say, would class him as a legend of their game, which I think so too. So he tried his best with Wexford, and it's just that I don't think he had the group, you know, the group of players that could challenge to the level he wants to challenge. I think that's fair. And it might take something of a rejuvenation through a new voice, Was that inside the county or outside? I don't know. Just to get Wexford back on the map again. But it's going to take time where they're going to have to reinvent themselves. There's still an over-reliance on one or two players whereby, you know, we know Chin is heavily relied upon. Dean Ryan's Foley's, it's very easy to point to the players. But for Wexford to make grounds going forward, they have to rejuvenate both the management position and the players themselves as well. I think to be fair, the same might be said for the Kenny Toomer, where, you know, it's easy to point towards the manager. But the manager can only do so much. It takes, and I know he or she is in charge of bringing in players. I absolutely agree with that. But the manager does so much, it's up to the players who come in to actually contribute. Because, again, I often say, look what youth can do to a team. But they can just change the landscape of your team, change the, you know, even how you perform on a grand level. So look at Galway, the three or four lads they brought in, you know, underage players. That's how fast it can change. So not to be too doom and gloom on the likes of Waterford and Wexford of the years, this can change very, very quick where you bring in a couple of quality players, but it just needs the right person at the helm to guide them.
Okay, we'll talk about the games this weekend. I'll tell you about the odds in them, which maybe gives a sense of the weekend to come. But the Hurling Pod here in Off the Ball is with thanks to Apple Green, helping you relax, recharge and enjoy the journey ahead. So just for Pig Iron, usually I don't talk odds on this podcast, but just to give you a feeling of where the bookmakers, who generally price these things correctly, feel about this. So Clare are currently 130 and Cork are 25-1 on. So, like, the feeling is that Clare and Cork 100% come through this weekend.
Sorry, this might be a stupid question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between 130 and 10-3?
You don't say 10-3 because it sounds like the time.
Well, okay.
It's the only reason they do the odds in that way.
I was there, I was going, why did it go as far as 130? Okay, 10-3.
But they're 10-3, as in they're, you'd have to put 10 on to win 3.
So, but
or you'd have to put 100 on to win 30.
They don't say 10-3 because it sounds like the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what about 5-1?
I don't know. But apparently that's the reason. I remember someone in...
Okay.
Maybe I'll be corrected in the comments, either on YouTube or on Spotify. But I think I remember someone in the racy set had said to me before, that's why they say the odds are 130 rather than 10-3.
That's a good... Right, so go on. Sorry, say that again. 130 and...
Either way, you'd have to put 100 quid on Clare to win 30, and you'd have to put 25 quid to win 1 if you were back in Cork for this weekend. So very clearly these are heavy, heavy favourites when it goes into both of these games in favour of the two teams from Munster. This is usually where we do prediction time, and this is usually where people turn around next week and go, those boys were right, those boys were wrong. And last year, let's be fair, nobody outside the Dublin camp was given Dublin a chance. I don't even think Big Garda Tom was given Dublin a chance when it came to the Limerick game. Was he last year, Skell? Did he turn around to you at some point and go, we're doing Limerick?
He did not.
And he is our stereotypical optimistic Dublin fan, even after the Leinster final just gone. This weekend, I'll give you a first shout on it, Skell. Clare and Dublin. If Dublin gets their level, can Dublin trouble Clare, and will they trouble Clare?
You see, there's a physical level and there's a mental level, Will.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think if Dublin are physically capable, whether that be fitness or strength, the skill level, I think they're behind Clare. But the mental level is a far far bigger issue for Dublin to contend with, because Dublin don't perform without Leinster. Let's be frank about that. That's just being frank.
The exception of quarterfinal last year.
People are pointing to the one quarterfinal. Yeah. Of course, Lucas, as I often say, a broken clock is right twice a day. Okay, great, I'll give you that one, right? But in particular attention to Thurles. I worry for them, I do. I can't see how they're going to contest Clare on this one. No, I'm not going to say Clare going to absolutely blitz them here or hammer the shit out of them, but I'm just seeing the evidence that I saw on last Saturday. When you put that into a 1v1 knockout game in Thurles with the Clare support, I just don't know, can Dublin contend with that mental load? And there's probably people listening to this from Dublin going, fuck you, I can hear you, I get you, okay, right? But just think about it for a second. If they couldn't contain with the mental load in the first half with Galway and then into the second half, when they're nearly practicing their home pitch, how are we going to do it around Thurles against Clare? Well, Clare are somewhat nearly the, you know, and you know what I mean by this, they're like the masters of the one-off, the knockout game. If it's 1v1 where, you know, it's in Thurles where they're absolutely fantastic at playing. We've seen that for their performances against Tipperary away. They're fantastic in Thurles. So the last team I want to play in Thurles in a knockout game, to be honest, is Clare. Straight up. I don't want to play them there. You know, and here we are. So I just don't think Dublin performed well in Clare. And the last time they played, you know, remember the Cork knockout game a couple of years ago?
Yeah, 24. Yeah,
that was a blitz and like ready to happen. Now Dublin did some good things, but you just knew from the off. A bit like the league final there this year, within the Division 1B final, you knew from the off that there was distances here in the two teams, both from a tactical perspective and also mentally, that Clare had this kind of swagger, confidence, I'd even nearly go say arrogance, that we're definitely going to win, and Dublin were kind of living in hope, you know. let's see what happens, you know, and then go from there. I think if Dublin start the first 5 or 10 minutes and they're given some kind of evidence that they can contest here, if we're in the game, then they grow. But if they're blitzed in the first 5 or 10 minutes, I can tell you, it's just gone. Game's over. I don't think they have the mental strength or capacity to take Clare on in Thurles. Sorry now. Murph, prove me wrong. Or say I'm wrong. Or say I'm right.
No, I'm not. I'm not. Like, I'm going to follow on from last week. Well, I'll say right, yeah. Like, the one thing for me that I learned about Dublin the previous week was that, and I'm sure a lot of people will say it's the same for their teams, but when Dublin don't play with intensity, they're not going to out-hurl a team. And you might have other teams there, like, they try to out-hurl Galway, whereas I'm going man for man in each position. Galway have the better hurlers, the better standalone hurlers. Whereas when Dublin play with intensity and they get in your face and they run at you, it suddenly causes a bit of confusion and they get the momentum. They didn't even do that against Galway. So I'm thinking if they go do this against Clare, or they don't do it against Clare, should I say, where they don't do any of that, Clare just win, because Clare have the better hurlers. Like, we're talking about Shane Meehan had a great game against Cork the last day, but he mightn't, as he came on and he was actually made an impact, but that he mightn't get into the starting six forwards this time. We've seen Clare also then, if we're talking about legacy and history, we've seen Clare go and win their last two All-Irelands from the quarter-final stage. Like, they're well able to go from quarter-final and get to an All-Ireland final. There's no issue there. I think Brian Lowen is really good at this as well. Like, when we looked at 24 and in the run into that, we were making our predictions. And I'm not saying, not hanging out here, Skell, but you went for Cork and myself and Will went for Clare. And I think, but I think mine and Will's feeling was just that Cork were favourites. Cork had the better team, we'll say, in terms of man for man. But pretty much the point you just made, where I think Clare are really good at standalone matches, just going out and doing what they need to do. We saw them rejigging the team then as well for the Tipperary match, and they paid huge dividends. So I think Lohan really focusing in on the fact that, listen, lads, I will start the best team that we're seeing in training. And I actually wouldn't discount Shane Meehan starting this game, because I heard a few good few Clare fans talking after the game, saying that they really liked that Shane Meehan came on and actually went at Cork when there was a few players, not say didn't stand up, but Clare were very flat that day in the last match in Munster against Cork. So he seems to be a case where Stritch was on the last day and he was unbelievable. Sorry, against Tipperary, he was absolutely unbelievable. Whereas that was maybe lacking in other games. So I think Lowen is going to reward those type of players. And for me, Dublin need to come with huge intensity. And even with that huge intensity, they need to be able to deal with a Clare team who are extremely adept at pulling players out of positions, creating chaos. When that chaos was introduced by Galway against Dublin, Dublin fell apart. They just weren't able to handle that. And if you look at the last 15 minutes, Galway and Dublin, like, Dublin were all out of their positions. They were all over the place. If Clare are going to run ragged, so Clare are going to move everywhere, like, Stritch is going to be starting, you can guarantee it. Tony Kelly, Shane O'Donnell, all these lads, and they will have a license to go anywhere they want in Thurles. How will Dublin deal with that? And it's that formation being broken is where I think this could be a problem for Dublin. Now, if Dublin come with intensity, there's lots of things capable. But I was at that match against Cork where they didn't perform for 60 minutes. And then the last 10 minutes, they kind of realised, this is 24, where they kind of realised that we're out of the championship if we don't hurl here in the next 10 minutes. And they kind of, there was a bit of a surge, but it was all far too late. So for me, even with that, you know, if Dublin come with that intensity and so on, I still think Clare are going to win this match. So I think it's going to take a huge performance. They showed it to us last year, but there's no ambush happening this year. Like, Clare forewarned, they will have seen Dublin play well this year. They will give them the full respect. And I think Clare are really good at preparing for these type of matches.
Yeah, Murph's going to be covering that game for us on Saturday for Off the Ball. I'm just glad this girl's getting hassled from the Dublin fans. It's not me being that meme kind of going, why me? Why am I getting hassled from the Dublin fans? But I won't break the prediction round table we have right now, which is Clare to win. I think it's across the board. The Cork game, I think the Offaly management need to show the video of the under 20 final from a few years ago where Cork bullied Offaly quite a bit and there were some decisions that didn't go their way. So Ben O'Connor and most of the management team that are currently with the seniors were with that under 20 group. Cork have had some of those hurlers migrate onto the senior team. Offaly have had a lot of players come from that under 20 group onto their senior team now. And hopefully the inspiration will be go out and don't get bullied like that day when it goes to Semple Stadium this weekend. But I can't help but feel that this could be a difficult one. This could be a really, really tricky day for Offaly. But hope springs eternal with the way that Offaly have played so far this year. I was glad to hear that Charlie Mitchell was able to go to Offaly training, I think it was last week or the week before, so he's in the middle of his recovery. He's not going to play again for this season, but it was good to hear that he was up and about and went to see them. Killian Sampson was saying during the week that was a big lift for them to have him there. I'm hoping that Adam Screeny can maybe get back into his form of the earlier stages of the league. I still wonder whether him and Cahill within the same forward line still work. But Cahill's been banging over the freeze, so you can't disagree with him starting this coming weekend. I think Offaly will have roughly the same team they played against Kildare and played against Wexford, so I know what to expect from Offaly. But I expect, Paul Murphy, a response from Cork after the Munster final.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, it will be truly rider over stuff if Offaly turn them over here, and that's not being disrespectful for Offaly. Offaly have had a fantastic year. They've been a huge example to other teams who come up from Joe McDonagh and, you know, hold their place in Lee McCarthy and then go and actually get out of Leinster. Like, that's been fantastic. With a very depleted panel as well. They've had their more than their fair share of injuries. And you mentioned Charlie Mitchell there as well. But like, we're talking about the number two team in the country at the moment. The only match they've lost this year has been by a point to Limerick, you know, which is, you know, outstanding. So based on that form alone, you know, you'd be a fool not to go for Cork. It's very hard. It's very hard to pull at the bones of this to see where it's going to come from.
Yeah, there's a Cork team who should have Dara Fitzgibbon back as well. We'll hear from Dara Fitzgibbon tomorrow. He's doing a media event. That's Monday, if you're listening to us on the pod on a Monday. Tommy Rooney's talking to him tomorrow afternoon. And we'll hear from John McGrath, the hurler of the year, on Tuesday. He's also doing a bit of media this week. So it's a big hurling week, despite the fact we've got round three of the football, Talton Cup as well. This is the most condensed weekend of the season, I think, coming up this weekend. Skeller, are you going to oppose Cork here?
I'm not going to oppose Cork. I think they've been very comfortable in quarterfinals in years previous, Will. We've often seen where they've played so-called lesser opposition and put them to the sword quite effectively. I can think of Laois, Dublin, as we just spoke about, and unfortunately I just see the same thing materialising here, because this is one where we talked about the energy previously, Will, where Cork are expected to win this and win it handsomely, but there's not a huge amount of pressure on their players, and the players will respond and blitz Offaly. That's my concern. But Offaly have proved me wrong twice this year. I honestly thought they'd be beaten by Dublin. I thought Kilkenny would beat them as well, and wrong both occasions. But I think the gap, the distance between both sides at the moment is just too vast, Will. It's just too fast. Now, it was 25-1 on. That's huge odds. That's signifying, you know, a 12, 13 point difference in teams.
The handicap is currently 14, I was told, by my barber yesterday. So
14, yeah. And I can materialize the conversation. Because my concern is Offaly is the goals, is getting goals. Now, not throwing slight at their defence or goalkeeper, it's just that the Cork forwards, when they get that ruthless kind of, you know, approach towards games, they can rattle 5 or 6 in you.
Exactly what happened in the Premier quarter final a couple of years ago when Cork played Offaly. Offaly put up a good score against them, but Cork just let rip entirely. And I remember we came out of that and we thought, this is 24. And people were like, wonder if Cork maybe a bit vulnerable at the back. And they went on to an All-Ireland final and they went extra time. So
Offaly could score 219 against Cork now, for example. But Cork could score 630 against you. That's the thing.
100%. Yeah. I'm hoping that doesn't happen. I'm intrigued to see who our special guest is potentially going to be this weekend. That's up to Murph now to pull a good one out of the hat. And Skell can pull one out the week after. So I hear cows in the background there as well.
Yeah, that's mine.
That's a perfect time to leave you, gentlemen. We will we'll chat again. We'll do a live on Sunday after the quarterfinals. So, Paul Murphy, for now, best of luck.
Thanks very much, lads.
Skell, you go attend to that cow.
Okay, God bless you.
The Hurling Pod.
On Off the Ball.
With Apple Green. Making every journey better.